This is Case Closed, crime stories from the golden age of radio. Today on Case Closed, we'll begin our hour of old-time radio crime with an episode from the 1950s from Secrets of Scotland Yard. This one's called Buckets of Blood. After that, it's the Black Museum and A Pair of Spectacles, their story from May 27th, 1952.
This is Clive Brooke. It is said that Christian II, a 16th century king of Denmark, was informed one night that a courtier had been stabbed and killed in a tavern brawl. The candles had been extinguished during the fight, and the murderer was consequently unknown. Now, determined to discover him, the king ordered all who had been present to reassemble in the tavern. One by one, they were made to lay their hands over the heart of the dead man. As the last man, a soldier, obeyed the king's command, blood trickled from the mouth of the corpse. Thereupon the soldier broke down and admitted the murder. This charming little tale is the origin of the belief that when confronted with the evidence of his guilt, the criminal will confess. Coupled with the maxim that a murderer will always return to the scene of his crime, it formed the basis of criminal detection for many years. The practice in England was to stick the head of a victim on the top of a pole and for officers of the law to stand guard over it, scrutinizing the demeanor of each passerby. This was done with the trunkless head that was discovered on the left bank of the Thames early in 1726. It was only one of the appetizing episodes in the casebook history I'm about to tell you. By way of warning, or perhaps inducement, I've called the case Buckets of Blood. It was in the foggy dawn of a day early in 1726 that a night watchman at Horse Ferry, Westminster, left his post and walked a few steps down to the edge of the Thames. As he neared the water, he tripped over something and fell into the mud. Kneeling, he turned to see what the object was. What he saw made him rise to his feet with a cry. It was a human head. He took his ghastly discovery to another watchman, and together they went to the magistrate of the district, Mr. Justice Lambert.
You two, what is the meaning of disturbing me at this hour? I've not even breakfasted.
Well, your lordship, it's like this. I'm a watchman.
Yes, but get to the point, man. What have you got in that sack?
Go on, Bill, shall we? I found this in the mud near my hat, sir, this morning.
Good heavens! Return it to the sack, man.
I stumbled on it as I was walking down to
Return it to the sack, will you? There's mud dripping all over my carpet.
I found this bucket just near where Bill found the head.
Take it out of the house, man. There's blood on it. It's bound to drip. Oh, my beautiful carpet.
All right, very good.
Well, what's to be done, your worship?
Soon, sir, the procedure is well and truly laid down. The head must be washed, the hair combed, and then this most ugly specimen shall be posted about St. Margaret's churchyard for all and sundry to see. Thus, we shall perhaps discover the identity of this bodiless corpse. And now, sir, you may depart, leaving the evidence in the scullery, if you please. Oh, what an unconscionable hour to be shown such a hideous object.
When the mud and blood had been washed away, it was seen that the head was that of a middle-aged man. But who he was or what he was, it was impossible to know. Crowds soon gathered about St. Margaret's churchyard to view the exhibit. And on the third day, a shopkeeper called Ashby, John Ashby, excitedly grasped his companion's arm.
Reg, look.
What is it, John?
The head on the pole.
Oh, I've already seen it. It's been up these past 3 days.
But for sure, it's a mess. Come with me, Reg.
Oh, you don't mean to drag me through this.
Come on.
Come on,
well, oh, now you've a close view, John. You satisfied?
Yes, I am. Come on, Reg.
Oh, now, look here, John. I refuse to be dragged about like this.
Very good, then. You go to the Eagle Tavern. I'll meet you there at 2 o'clock.
Now, where will you be until then?
I shall be talking to Mrs. Catherine Hayes about that head up out there on the pole.
I must tell you how she came to be in London and why Mr. Ashby wanted to see her about the head on the pole. Now, at the age of 15, Catherine had quarreled with her father, a labourer, and had left her parents' home when she set off to walk to London 100 miles to the Crow Flies. But at the first hospital she came to, she was diverted from her course.
Oh,
Glad that you're a company wench, eh? What they call you, my pretty one?
Cat, so please you, sir.
So please me, eh? Gad, but you please me greatly. Do you work here, Cat?
No, sir. I'm on my way to London.
London City's no place for you, my lovely. Look about the room, lass. What do you see?
A goodly lot of men, sir. Fine officers all, I'd
say. Indeed we are, begad. His Majesty's truest and most loyal soldiers, what? And we've all got a good eye for a woman, Cat. A woman like you. Fine complexion, heavenly figure. How old are you, by the way?
15, sir. But older than my years.
I'll wager you. You've had a fine life with us, Cat, in our camp, you know. We've quarters at Great Ombersley. We're on our way there now.
But that is in Worcestershire, sir. I'm for London.
You were for London, Cat, but now... it's a fine life with the King's officers, Cat. Mm.
Sir, you must not do that in so public a place.
Are you still for London, eh, Cat?
No, sir. I think I'm for His Majesty's officers, sir.
But after 2 years, the officers became tired of Cat's company, and she was advised to leave the barracks. Her next stop was in the county of Warwickshire, where she became servant to a farmer called Hayes. The farmer had a son, and Cat at 17 was extremely attractive. Thus it came about that the elder Hayes soon found cause to have a serious talk with his son.
Oh, come in, Arthur. I want to speak to you.
It's about Catherine, isn't it, Dad?
Yeah, you always were an honest lad. Yes, it's about Cat. She's only been with us a month, and people are already whispering about you and her.
Let them whisper. I was planning to tell you anyway. Cat and I are married.
What? How can you be? This is a joke, some prank of yours.
No prank, Dad. We married secretly in Worcester last week. We're very much in love, Dad. I hope you won't do anything to make unpleasantness.
Married to a mere scrat of a serving girl?
Whatever you may say, you shan't alter my feelings.
You'll both leave this house tomorrow. I never want to see either of you again.
I'd hope you'd welcome
me. Wretch, how dare you hope for anything after such action? Out of my house, to you, eh? Out!
Yes, Dad, I heard.
But the next morning, Hayes Sr. repented a little and gave his son money on the condition that he and his wife should leave the district. He also granted him an allowance of £26 a year. No mean sum in those days. Cath refused to live anywhere but London. And as Arthur Hayes was at this time still anxious to grant his bride's every whim, to London they went. Arthur took a house and let apartments. He made money. He opened a chandler's shop and sold coal. He made more money. He started a pawnbroker's business. He made yet more money. But he was by no means happy.
Cath, this cannot go on.
What do you mean?
It's the third time this week that neighbors have come to me with their complaints about you. Robinson from number 20 has just been in here saying he'd murder you if you crossed his path again.
I hope you punished him for speaking in such fashion of your wife.
I'm tired of standing up for you, Cath. Is it true that you told his wife that you'd seen him with that woman in the park?
Of course I told her. You know what I think of such things. And if we women did not stand together...
Why must you be forever making trouble with my friends? John Ashby was in here only yesterday asking if it was you who spread the rumor that he couldn't pay his rent.
Well, he can't, you know it.
And who are you to tell everyone about it? No one is perfect, you least of all. Do you think I don't know what happens in this house when I'm away on business?
How dare you?
Oh, don't deny it. Spare me that.
Arthur, how can you? My husband. You know I love you more than anyone or anything.
We leave here on Tuesday, Cat. You're ruining my trade and my reputation in the neighborhood. I've taken a house in Tyburn Road. We'll make a fresh start there.
But the change of environment did not alter Catherine's nature. She still made trouble for her husband. She still was unfaithful to him when his back was turned. However, Arthur, in spite of his unhappy home life, continued to prosper in his pawnbroker's business. He also let 3 rooms of his house as apartments. One of the lodgers was a young tailor called Thomas Billings. Catherine liked his looks, and he hers. By the way, he was young enough to be her son. The mutual attraction led to a most severe quarrel between Arthur Hayes and his erring wife.
And I returned from labouring to keep you in your expensive ways, only to be told that Billings has been more than just a lodger in my absence.
Do you expect me to sit alone while you're away? Am I to have no company?
Not only do you cheat me at every turn, but you have such an orgy here with him that the whole neighborhood hears of it and laughs at me and pities me for being a fool, a deceived man.
You are a fool. Cannot you open your eyes? See that you no longer please me? I wish for a change, Arthur. I'm still young, you know.
Another word in that tone, Catherine.
You blind idiot. Do you expect me to deny the advances of an attractive youngster like... Oh, you brute!
Perhaps that will quiet.
And strange to relate, Catherine's disposition changed from that day forward in Arthur's presence. To him, she was gay and charming. But to Billings and another lodger named Wood, two rather simple souls, she showed her true feelings towards her husband, and they were not quite so charming.
You know, Mr. Wood, what a good-for-nothing Arthur is.
Well, he's been a good friend to me, Mrs. Hayes. Billings here can vouch for that, can't you, Tom?
Well, I don't think he's all he seems to be.
That's right, Tom. Of course he isn't. Two things you don't know. First, he's an atheist.
Is he?
Yes. And I've heard it preached that to kill such men is right. So what sin it must be. And worse than that, he's a murderer.
No.
Would I say it about my own husband if it were not true? He killed two men in the country, buried them under a pear tree. That's why we came to live in London.
My word, an atheist and a murderer.
And with all that money, too.
Yes, £1,500 he saved. All of it comes to me on his death. But what a scoundrel he is, eh?
These arrant lies were not just idle chatter on the part of Catherine Hayes. Every story she concocted was told with a purpose. To secure the assistance of Messrs. Wood and Billings in the murder of her husband. With her lodgers, Wood and Billings, on the best way to dispose of her husband. Still undecided, they were given some unexpected help by their victim. One night, Wood returned from work to find Mr. and Mrs. Hayes and Billings in an uproarious mood. They'd been apparently shutting out the cold with the aid of large quantities of liquor.
Good evening, Mr. Wood.
You look cold.
There's a bad fog outside.
Never mind the fog, Woody. Join us and drink up.
Yes, it's the best remedy for a cold in the world.
Drunk over a guinea's worth of liquor.
You know, I'm not drunk. Are you, Tom? Drunk? Not I. See, Hayes, I'll wager you couldn't drink 6 bottles of Mountain and still be sober. If you can, I'll pay for it. And if it knocks you over, you pay.
A bargain, a bargain. 6 bottles of Malaga, eh? Pour me a thirst quencher.
I'll get the bottles. Have a drink, Mr. Wood.
Kick furniture.
Well done, Tom. It was just the right moment. Now remember your promise, you two.
What tonight?
The best opportunity we've had. He's sure to be drunk after this.
But I did not pledge myself.
You did. To get rid once and for all of a murderer. To kill him means less than to kill a dog in the gutter. And I'll not be stingy with the money. You promised, didn't he, Tom?
I heard him with these 2 ears. All right.
Sweet lass, I'll reach for you, sweet lass. Halfway through the first bottle already.
I'll do it easily, Billings.
Go to it then, Hayes. You've still got another 5 bottles.
That's one. Can't be bothered with tankard from the bottle now. Up for a bit of air. Only a few more. Oh, spilt. Spilt, hang it. I spilt some.
Oh, don't count it against me, Billings.
You're doing marvels, Hayes.
Hurrah, finished. 6 bottles of Mountain. And you pay. Where am I? I'm so giddy.
He's completely insensible. Carry him onto his bed. Take the legs, Billings. I've got the shoulders.
Heavy with all that wine in him, huh? There, you lead the way.
Lay him on the bed. I'll fetch the hatchet.
Catherine Hayes returned. Billings took the hatchet from her and struck Hayes on the head, but it was not sufficient. So Wood snatched the hatchet from Billings and dealt the victim 2 more blows.
What shall we do with the body?
Throw it right into Marylebone Pond. We'll burn the clothes. The head we must put in the bucket and carry to Westminster, where we can throw it into the Thames. No one will ever find out who it is. Quickly now, we must finish by daybreak.
And so it was that a watchman at Horse Ferry, Westminster, stumbled over something the next morning, and that a man called Ashby, 3 days later, thought he recognized the head on the pole in St. Margaret's churchyard and went to see Mrs. Catherine Hayes.
Yes? Oh, it's Mr. Ashby, isn't it?
I wasn't sure whether you'd remember me.
Oh, yes. You knew my husband before we moved here.
Is your husband in, Mrs. Hayes?
No. Arthur's away.
Oh? May I know where?
Portugal.
You're sure, Mrs. Hayes? I have reason to doubt it. But perhaps you can convince me. Why has he gone to Portugal?
It's a sad story, Mr. Ashby. Some time ago, my Arthur fought with a man. The man died from the blows Arthur struck, and his wife was going to the constables about it. But finally she agreed to say nothing on Arthur's promising to pay a certain annual allowance to her. Recently, Arthur lost a lot of money. He could no longer pay the woman the money, so he has fled to Portugal.
I see. Thank you, Mrs. A.
Good day.
Ashby quickly repaired to the Eagle Tavern to meet his friend, Reg Longmore, and there told him what Catherine Hayes had said, explaining also that he was sure that the head in St. Margaret's churchyard was that of Catherine's husband. Between them, they decided to test her story, which is the reason that Longmore visited the lady that afternoon, pretending that he was a friend of Arthur's. He was told the same story. Almost.
But then, you see, Mr.
Longmore, ma'am.
Mr. Longmore, my poor husband lost an amount of money so that he could no longer afford to pay this widow the allowance. In the end, against my wishes, of course, he decided to leave the city.
And where did he go, ma'am? Oh, I wouldn't tell anyone, you understand, but I would like to make contact with him, if possible.
North of London, sir. He gave me no more exact address, but I think he is in Hertfordshire County.
Oh, indeed. Well, thank you, Mrs. Hayes. You've been most helpful.
And she never mentioned Portugal once?
No, not once. Oh, she was not quite certain, but she thought he was in Hertfordshire. I think you're right about this affair, John.
Well, I'm sure of it. Something else has happened since I saw you to confirm me in my suspicion.
Oh?
I went to see a rogue called Billings after you left me. He's a tailor and lodges in Arthur Hayes' house. I asked him if he'd seen the head in St. Margaret's churchyard.
Well, go on.
He said he hadn't. Whereupon I disclosed that I was sure it was his landlord's. And you know what was his reply? He cried, "Nonsense. How could the head be his? I left him well in bed when I came to work this morning."
John, and we can go no further in the matter, for we cannot take the law into our own hands. Justice Lambert's the man for us.
You speak truth, Rich, though I'm determined to be there when they make the arrest.
On being told the story, Mr. Justice Lambert decided that there was a prima facie case against Catherine Hayes, and that he would attend to the arrest himself. Summoning the assistance of two officers of the lifeguards, and followed by Ashby and Longmore, he appeared at Mrs. Hayes' lodgings at 9 o'clock that night. With no ceremony, they walked upstairs to her room.
Open in the name of the law!
Who's there?
Open in the name of the law!
As soon as I have put up the
clothes! Hurry then, madam! Officer, have you the casket I gave you as we set out?
Yes, your worship, I have it here.
It shall perhaps be required before this episode is through. Now, madam, are you prepared?
What do you want?
Officers, seize her.
Look, there's Billings sitting on her bed.
Thomas Billings, eh? I have a warrant for your arrest also.
Make up another of your stories, Billings.
Billings has been mending his stockings.
His eyesight must be extremely good then, seeing that there is neither fire nor candle in the room.
Why are we being arrested?
Officer, give me that box.
Here you are, your worship.
Lift out its grisly contents. There, madam. Do you not recognize this?
Oh, it is my dear husband.
Here now, wife.
That's better. In my arms like this, instead of that box. I must have a lock of his hair. Oh.
She's fainted.
She has perhaps seen too much of his blood already.
The same night, and the three criminals were then taken to the Old Bailey to await trial. Billings was the first to speak out in the hope of being treated leniently. On his advice, Marylebone Pond was dragged, and the remaining limbs of Arthur Hayes were discovered. Wood then confessed also that in spite of the whole ghastly crime being disclosed, Catherine Hayes maintained her innocence.
Catherine Hayes, your companions Wood and Billings have confessed to the murder of your husband, Arthur Hayes, and have pleaded guilty in the forthcoming trial. As examining magistrate, it is my duty to inform you that unless you alter your plea of not guilty, you will have to make a defense, for which, in due course, you will be provided counsel. The enormity of your alleged offense has induced the king, whose gracious majesty may God preserve, to direct the prosecution through no less a personage than the attorney general.
In the trial that then took place, the attorney general of England argued for the supreme penalty of the law in those days, hanging and then burning. The jury, in spite of Catherine's repeated cries that she was being wronged, brought in the verdict after only a few minutes.
Members of the jury, look on this woman. Do you find her guilty or not guilty of the foul crime with which she is charged?
We find her guilty.
My lord!
The female prisoner at the bar may speak.
You have found me guilty, but I did not strike the fatal blow. Billings and Woody have admitted to that themselves. If I must suffer hanging, surely in view of their confession, I may escape burning.
The request of the prisoner is denied. Catherine Hayes, you have been found guilty, by just process of law, of a most foul and heinous crime.
To be burnt after hanging was a fate reserved for women. Men were hanged and then suspended by chains near the scene of the crime. Although Catherine's second assistant, Wood, cheated the gallows by dying in Newgate the day before his appointed execution, the corpse of Thomas Billings was duly strung up near Marylebone Pond, where the remains of Arthur Hayes had been discovered. As to the chief instigator of the crime, her end was almost more horrible than that of her victim. On May the 9th, 1726, the crowd about Tyburn, in spite of the layer of snow on the ground, was so great that only a few could see the gallows. But among those few were John Ashby and Reg Longmore, more than a little proud of their share in the apprehension of no longer Kath or Catherine, but just the woman Hayes.
Here she comes, Reg. Can't see her face at the moment.
Oh, they brought her on a sledge. Oh, I wish they'd silenced that bell.
It's the death knell from St. Sepulchre's Church. It'll stop when she dies. See, they're chaining her to the stake. First they'll strangle her and then light the faggots.
She looks calm.
They've got the rope round her neck. Any moment now, she's up.
Look, they lit the fire too soon.
John, I can't see. They lit the fire too soon. The hangman ain't then first and has to let the rope go. She's trying to kick the faggots away.
Strange, perhaps, that fate should reserve such a death for such a woman. In any case, that was the macabre finale to the history of Catherine Hayes. Don't be too horrified by this story. It took place a long time ago, when it was much more difficult to keep a good head on your shoulders.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum, a repository of death, a museum of murder. Yes, here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a portable typewriter, a jack for an automobile, an ice pick, all are touched by murder. Here's a pair of spectacles. It's a familiar object, neat, not too large, tortoiseshell frames with gold tops. You've seen them 100 times on girls who obviously have decided that they must wear glasses. They'll make the glasses as decorative as possible, but this pair...
Women's glasses, right on top in the suitcase.
And pretty thoroughly smashed. Poor Daisy.
Something Whatever it was, must have hit her awfully hard to smash her spectacles like this.
Today, well, today, those spectacles can be seen in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum. In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. Museum starring Orson Welles.
Now here we are in the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's Museum of Murder. Yes, here lies death. Who died by these objects? The dead, named here on the white labels of the black lettering, or the killers, named in equal place, in equal size, wherever they are known. A mandolin string. Here we are. It's made for music, a mandolin string. Stretch it across the top of a stairway, see it blend and disappear into the dark carpet background. Stretch it ankle high and listen in the dark for the sound of falling. Sound of murder. Here's a French novel, romance, with a blackened perforation in the center of the pages where the bullet passed, which ended romance. Now, here we are, the spectacles. Rather pathetic spectacles. The lenses are cracked, the frame twisted and bent, the gilt tarnished. Many other things were tarnished, including a man's reputation, by the chain of events which began that morning when Mrs. Oliver came to see Inspector Laswell at the yard.
I understand, Mrs. Oliver. Perhaps your daughter thought she'd let you know, but didn't after all.
Oh, I wish I could believe that, Inspector. I can't. Daisy was so determined when she left that night.
And since she went to the train, you've heard nothing?
I wired Ron. I never liked him. Something, I don't know, I thought my Daisy'd do better for herself than a chicken farmer. Anyway, I wired, asked him if Daisy was there. I received this in reply, Inspector.
Thought Daisy coming Saturday, not Friday. Went to meet her, not there. Letter follows. Ron Smith. This was last Saturday?
Yes. I wired on Monday. This answer came back the same day. The letter came in yesterday, Wednesday.
Oh, thank you. Dear Mrs. Oliver, you do not know how shocked I am. Daisy missing since Friday afternoon. This is really terrible. She wrote asking me to meet her Saturday. I went.
The heartsick words of a worried man, the tone and feeling of the letter, plus the fear and the tears of the mother, sent Inspector Caswell to Larkspur in Sussex, the nearest town to Wren Smith's chicken farm, the railway terminal for the area. He turned first to that prime source of all rural information, the local pub.
Evening, landlord. Pint of beer, please.
Yes, sir, of course.
Haven't I seen you someplace before, my good man?
What? Jack Sheen. You have seen me someplace before. But drink up, man. It's good to see a familiar face. A
familiar face drawn by a familiar scent.
You're not down here on business.
I am. And so are you.
No, I wanted to keep this quiet for a while, anyway.
With that crowd over at the dartboard? Your old-time friends, Caswell. Morton of the Times, Alsop of the Guardian, Durr of the News, and yours truly.
You fellows have a sense of smell of a ferret.
We have to. It's our living. Do you think the girl is dead, Caswell?
There it was. Words of one syllable. Literally one syllable. Do you think the girl is dead? Inspector Caswell shrugged and turned to his drink. Without apparent effort, he drifted into conversation with the landlord while Jack Sheen stood by, quietly, unobtrusively.
Have there been any talk hereabouts recently? About a girl who's missing?
Some?
Well, girls get silly ideas sometimes, especially the young ones.
Only silly thing about this girl was the man she went for.
Huh?
They get that way sometimes, even the best of them.
Oh, I know what you mean. Anything wrong with the man in it?
Ne'er do well. Owes for feed. Everything in sight. Lives in a hut on his farm. Not even a proper house.
Oh, that's it?
This Oliver girl now. Bright. Sweet as they come. Real pert in them fancy glasses she always wore. Then, off the deep end over this Smith fella. Never know why they do it.
Whereabouts is this chicken farm?
Right fork east. Second right after the fork. You're thinking of going up there?
Oh, I might drop over. Told the girl's mother I'd look around. Maybe talk to Smith. From his letters, he's pretty well upset himself.
Him? Upset over that girl? Not much. What's happened to your friend?
My friend? Why, he was just... Five will get you 10, landlord. My friend is halfway there by now.
Inspector Caswell was absolutely right. Jack Sheen was well up the right fork and turning into the lane that led to Ron Smith's chicken farm.
Who's there? I said, who's there?
I'm Jack Sheen of the London Daily Post. I'd like to talk to you.
What makes you think I want to talk to you?
Oh, most people talk to me. If they don't, I usually write what I think they might have said. Very simple.
Smart, aren't you?
I know my business, I hope. Fellows down in the village suggest you don't.
Yeah, they like to talk.
Don't you?
Not about things that ain't my business.
Daisy Oliver is your business.
She was.
Meaning, exactly?
Daisy said she was coming down last Friday. I left my gate unlocked, like you found it tonight. She was always touchy about that.
She never came, though.
That's right. Now, all this talk. I'm more worried about her than I ought to be. Nancy's going to make a fuss about that pretty soon.
Nancy? Well?
A girl, Nancy Noble, lives up the road a piece. Her and me have been walking out lately. Daisy knew. I figured she'd be coming down like she wrote on account of...
Apparently, Mr. Ron Smith, chicken farmer, was as garrulous in his way as his hands were in theirs. He clucked on at great rate. Finally, Jack Sheen got away, scribbled a bit in his notebook, and then off to sleep. The next morning, quite early...
Hello there.
What? Oh, you startled me.
You don't look as if you scare easy.
I don't. Oh, you walking into a barn like this behind a busy girl's back.
A fellow who thinks you'd make a better wife for Ron Smith than some frail little girl from the city.
You know your way around, don't you?
There was banter and introductions. Nancy was quite flattered, of course, over the visit of a reporter. She talked.
Sure, I met Daisy.
Like her?
All right. If you go for milksops.
I see. I heard Ron was going to marry her right after Christmas.
Not if he could break the engagement, he wasn't. He's all set to marry me.
Oh, so that's the way the wind blows, huh?
It sure does. Or did. Now, with all the fuss over Daisy disappearing, well, Ron's too upset even to think, I guess.
Upset, is he?
He told me, night before last. He's afraid she's killed herself.
So Daisy may be dead. And Ron is afraid she may have committed suicide. Well... Jack Sheen has turned up a fact or two, hasn't he? Of course, Inspector Caswell hasn't been inactive.
Mr. Jeffrey, I'm told by our host, the landlord, that you think you saw the Oliver girl last Friday night.
I think so. I was coming up the road, out past the fork. My place is out past, miss. There was a girl ahead of me. She turned to look back. I thought I saw her wearing spectacles.
Is that all?
Well, she must have turned in at Smith's. She didn't pass my place. Reed here saw her real close.
Did you, Mr. Reed?
Yes, sir. I met Jeffrey on the road. I was coming down to the water of the village after fixing the septic tank out to Jeffrey's place. Girl passed real close. Jolly girl, all right. Wearing her specs and carrying a suitcase.
Ah, that's right. She had a suitcase like she walked out from the train. Why, the Smith fella didn't go in and meet her.
Then there was the routine visit to the cottage where Daisy usually stayed when she was in Larkspur.
Did you hear from Miss Oliver, ma'am, that she was coming down here this past Friday?
She didn't, and she always tailed with me. If she'd planned to come down, well, you never know, what with young girls being so free nowadays. And she had spent all her savings on these trips. She told me that last time she was here.
Well, when was that?
Oh, about 2 months ago. She seemed so nervous, poor thing. Even then, you know, jumpy, always a little scared, like a rabbit, sort of. Oh, I don't know. I wish I didn't keep thinking.
And finally, there was Edith Staple. Miss Staple had a friend in the outlying area, and Miss Staple had been crossing a field near the chicken farm, a kind of shortcut.
Yes, Inspector, I'm positive I saw her. I saw two men on the road, too. One passed her. The men met, talked a little, and went on. By the time I passed the lane to Smith's place, she was in as far as the first shed.
You saw quite a bit, didn't you?
The road is on a little rise just there. I was coming up to it, and everyone was, well, sort of outlined against the sky.
Well, thank you, Miss Staple. Thank you very much.
There must have been a girl. 9 chances out of 10 it was Daisy Oliver. But how to prove it? Where had she disappeared to? Inspector Caswell and Jack Sheen compared notes. They stayed around Larkspur. That fact alone started the talk, which had impetus enough in any case.
People don't just disappear, I tell you. She must be somewhere.
She turned into Smith's place. Want to bet she never came out?
Nice girls don't take chances going alone to men's homes, even when they're more decent than the utter he lives in.
They'll get him, you'll see. He did the girl in. Want a bet?
The talk reached Smith, of course. On the heels of the talk came Jack Sheen.
Nice lot of chickens you've got here, Smith.
You didn't come out here to talk about chickens.
No? What then?
You're trying to get more on Daisy and me.
The town has plenty on you, they think.
Yeah, long tongues. They wag too much.
You can stop them, you know, quite easily.
How, I'd like to know.
Oh, just ask Inspector Caswell to bring his crew out here to dig up your farm. They'll find nothing. That'll stop the talk.
I'll do it. They can dig any place they want. Except I wouldn't want them to disturb my chickens.
The remarks were duly reported to the inspector. His comment was...
We'll be glad not to disturb his chickens.
I should think that's exactly what you would do.
Oh, I don't know a thing about chickens, except roasted.
Look, he was rather pointed about it, you know. Don't disturb my chickens. You know, if I were you, Caswell, I'd do some digging around that chicken run. Might save you a lot of extra trouble. You catch on, Inspector?
The inspector caught on to the extent of asking Ron Smith to drop in at the police station while Jeffrey and Reed and a few of the others with Jack Sheen began their digging.
Not much good this ground. Good enough for chickens.
Got something?
No, just a rotten stick. Nothing suspicious like.
There's something here.
Yes, I'd say you had something there. Lift out your shovel, Jeffrey.
Okay.
Now, look, I'm going to open it. I want you to witness that I neither take out nor put in any object. Ready?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, now just watch this.
It's the girl's suitcase, all right. I'd know those specs any place.
Well, today those spectacles can be found in the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles. And now we continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
It was her suitcase. Yes, there it was, the earth of the Chicken Run clinging to its freight handle, its shabby sides. Jack Sheen stopped the digging, sent Reed pell-mell for the inspector.
Women's glasses, right on top in the suitcase.
And pretty thoroughly smashed. Poor Daisy.
Something, whatever it was, must have hit her awfully hard to smash her spectacles like this.
Shall we go on, Inspector?
Digging? Of course. But carefully. We don't want the edges of the spades to disfigure anything.
The first thing they found was part of the torso. Then the limbs wrapped in sacking. Finally, the head in a tin box, buried shallowly in the Chicken Run.
Boy, I've had enough. Are we through?
Sorry, I didn't have a regular police crew for this. You can go along. And thanks. You too, Mr. Reed.
Where's Smith?
At your local police station, where Mr. Sheen and I will be interviewing him in a very short while.
They interviewed him. It was quite simple at first. I gave him the facts.
We've found her, Smith. Thanks to Mr. Sheen here and the strong arms of some of your neighbors. Well, what have you to say? First, I must warn you that anything you may say may be taken down in writing and used as evidence. Now, go ahead.
I didn't kill her. I didn't.
That's only a beginning.
She came down on Friday to have it out with me. She was so nervous, she was all twitchy. She said she wouldn't leave my place until we'd set a date for the wedding. But she knew about Nancy, she knew that. We had a row, a real hard row. I guess I gave in. I said the 27th of December, right after Christmas. Then I promised I'd tell Nancy that night. Daisy wasn't satisfied until I'd gone right out looking for Nancy. I couldn't find her. I came back and Daisy was hanging from the beam in my hat. She must have jumped from the table. It was awful.
What did you do? Why didn't you go for help, a doctor?
Well, I cut her down first. I thought there might be some life left.
Did you try artificial respiration?
And as soon as I got her on the bed, I saw it was no use.
But you still didn't call anybody.
I was afraid. I panicked. I thought they wouldn't believe me. They'd all think I killed her and try to make it look like suicide.
So you buried her?
Yes, in the morning.
But you cut her up first. You deliberately dismembered the body in an attempt...
Have you ever tried to dispose of a body? True, a body is 76% water, but... you ever tried to get rid of one? It's almost impossible to burn without special apparatus. Burying it leaves it intact. What do you do? Find a lime pit? Even that isn't foolproof. What do you do?
After you knew she was dead, you still wrote letters to her home.
I couldn't stop doing that. If people were to believe that I hadn't killed her myself.
May I, Inspector?
Of course, Jack.
What about these?
Her glasses. You found them, too.
How did they get this way?
Well, they must have fallen off when I cut her down. I suppose I stepped on them or something. Her head hit the table as I was carrying her to the bed. I couldn't believe Daisy was gone. I couldn't...
Smith couldn't believe she was dead. Jack Sheen and Inspector Caswell couldn't believe other items.
It doesn't fit, Caswell. It doesn't.
What's bothering you about it?
Look, a girl who's just been told her wedding date doesn't hang herself in the next half hour.
Oh, I saw that. I sent his shoes down to London to the laboratory. If he did step on those glasses, there'll be bits of glass on the soles or heels.
I'm no doctor, Caswell, but did you notice any rope marks on the neck?
I didn't. I have sent for one of the medical examiners. We'll know all about that very soon.
The They held Smith on an open charge. The least would be an illegal burial and failure to notify the proper authorities. Meanwhile, Sir Harold Hubert, one of the Yard's best medical men, came to Larkspur. He worked. He made his report.
The girl did not die of strangulation, gentlemen.
What was that? She didn't.
There's a slight discoloration of the throat, but that was probably caused after death.
Well, what did she die from, then?
Shock. Caused by the multiple bruises all over her body. That girl was beaten to death.
Now the questions descended on Sir Harold's head in a deluge.
No sign of strangulation at all.
She may have been partially hung. There's congestion of the blood vessels at the throat.
But she didn't die up there.
If she was hung at all, she was alive when she was cut down.
What else could have caused the congestion in the throat?
Manual strangulation. Or she could have been knocked down, as is a logical assumption in this situation.
Did you knock her down and step on her throat, Smith?
Of course not. How could I have when she was hanging as I entered the building?
You're certain she was hanging and dead?
I know she was hanging. I'm as sure as I can be that she was dead.
All right. Take him back to the cell.
There it was. The expert said no hanging. The man accused contradicted that statement at every turn. Once again, the inspector and Jack Sheen went out to the chicken farm.
What are you up to?
Give me a boost. Up onto the table.
Okay. Now what?
I'm not going to hang myself. Come on up. I think it'll hold both of us.
All right. Here I come. Huh. Not the safest perch in the world. Okay, now what?
Look here. Along the beam.
What a filthy animal. Didn't Smith ever clean his place?
Maybe it's just as well he never did. Yeah.
Look, I don't get it.
He said a dozen times he found her hanging. If a rope passed over this beam, as Smith maintains...
The dust up here would show the marks.
You see any marks, old boy?
Not a thing. Not even a bit of rope fiber.
Sir Harold is right. No death by strangulation. Not by any rope which passed over this beam. I wonder how friend Smith is...
Smith did his best to explain the matter. In fact, he did a trifle better than his best. That's possible.
The rope must have caught in the joists. She didn't weigh very much.
And by the way, where is the rope?
I burned it. It gave me the willies.
What kind of rope was it?
Ordinary hemp rope.
Not sash cord?
No, hemp.
What did you intend it for?
Oh, no special purpose. You always have rope around a farm.
Inspector Caswell reminded Mr. Smith quite tersely.
Hemp rope leaves its fibers caught in rough wood when it's passed over the wood. There's no sign of fibers or any mark in the dust.
Well, then the dust settled back after I took her down.
How did you take her down?
I lifted her with one arm and freed the rope with the other.
Now, let's go back to the beginning, Smith. When did you first see her that night?
Oh, she came to the gate. It was locked. She called. I let her in. We argued. Then we made up, and I went to tell Nancy. When I came back...
Hadn't you better keep the story straight, Smith?
That is the story.
You said before you cut her down. You told Mr. Sheen you left the gate open because finding it closed upset her always.
Then I made a mistake.
Oh, you made a mistake, all right. You made your story much too involved. You see, the laboratory has reported on your shoes. Not only are there no bits of glass in them, proving you did not step on them, but there are traces of lipstick on one and traces of contact with human skin on both. I submit, and I shall so state to the jury at your trial, that you attacked the girl with force and violence, that you smashed her glasses on the table, that you beat and kicked her into insensibility and death. Your story tripped you, and the laboratory did the rest. I'd say, Smith, next time, keep it simple. But I doubt if there'll be any next time for you.
Well, today, those spectacles can be seen in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment. Now here in person is Orson Welles.
Exactly how Daisy Oliver met her death was never brought out, not even at the trial. Whether Ron Smith beat her to death or whether she fell to her death, no one knows. But she was murdered, and by Ron Smith, there's no reasonable doubt about that. Nor was there any doubt about this man's character. Not only did he write of his concern over her disappearance to Daisy's mother, not only did he write long, enduring love letters to a girl he knew was dead, but from his cell, as he awaited trial, he sent a wreath to her funeral, palm leaves and one lily, with the phrase attached, "Until we meet again." I wonder if they ever did meet again. Well, until next time, till we meet in the same place and I tell you another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
Going to do it for this hour of Case Closed. I'll be back next Wednesday with another one. And between now and then, you can find past episodes of Case Closed, more from Secrets of Scotland Yard, The Black Museum, and a variety of other types of shows, all available for free at relicradio.com. We've got thousands of old-time radio episodes available to listen to there. If you'd like to help support it, give that donate button a click. Your support makes all of this possible. There are some downloadable sets for certain donation amounts, though any amount is always helpful and appreciated. Thanks to those who have helped out. Thanks for joining me today. Be back next Wednesday with another episode of Case Closed.